stalk. Armed with U.S. bombs and missiles, Israel destroys Palestinian homes in an instant. Palestinian suffering and trauma will endure for generations. One, ethnic cleansing, genocide, and the consolidation of its century-old settler colonial regime. So says Israeli author and activist Burr. The GPM sat down with Jeff Halper for a wide-ranging discussion about the deep roots of Israel's current war on the people of Gaza and about Washington's unstinting support for Israeli ultraviolence and oppression. Jeff Halper is a founding member of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. I spoke with Jeff Halper in his home in West. Hello, Jeff Halper.
Hello, David Kattenberg.
For people who've never heard of Jeff Halper, much less met him.
There aren't any.
How would you describe yourself? Who is Jeff Halper? You've been an activist for decades and decades and decades. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, who are you?
Well, I guess the best definition would be a child of the 60s. You know, I was at the epitome of the 60s, the class of 68 at the university. This is the height of the 60s.
And you were born in Hibbing, Minnesota.
Born in Hibbing, Minnesota.
Dylan's hometown.
So I was born, I knew Bob as a kid. You know, I was a draft resistor to the Vietnam War. I was in Mississippi during the civil rights movement. I was at Woodstock. I was at the Chicago Convention in 1968 with Mayor Daley and the whole police riot. So I'm really kind of I checked all the boxes of what it meant to be a 60s radical at that time.
And were you raised, you're Jewish, of course, were you raised as a Zionist? Were you raised in...
Up in Hibbing, no one ever heard of Zionism. I mean, there was nothing like that. It was just a small town, Jewish family. There was the Jewish doctor in town. Hibbing itself was kind of a radical place. You know, it was the center of the iron ore mining industry. And I worked in the mines for
the
a while.
Iron Range.
The Iron Range. And it was populated by immigrants from Sweden, Finland especially, Croatia, Italy. And then there were Native Americans there as well. So that there are no white, you know, the WASPs that would be the ones that you had to kowtow to that you had to melt into. So it was a kind of a society in which the workers from all these different countries kind of acculturated each other. So it was, in a sense, a very left-wing, left political, you know, the cooperative movement in the United States started in northern Minnesota. So it was a very strong socialist, cooperative, left-wing culture that I came out of. I'm sure it affected Bob Dimmerman. But it certainly affected me as well. And then, you know, those days, if you were like a young Republican, somehow you were a pariah or you were just weird or whatever. So in other words, I grew up in an area of the country that was very left-wing and working class, and then moved into the country in general that became, you know, the 60s. With all the activism and everything else. So that stayed with me. So when I came to Israel, I wasn't a Zionist, but the 60s ended on January 1st, 1970. And we begin to get into the whole neoliberal era. You know, Nixon's elected. And so we have to remember that at the height of the 60s, Nixon's elected in 68. And then we'd get into the Reagan era and so on. So I became more and more alienated from life in the States. It just seemed to be dumb and pointless and meaningless. And, you know, and the whole consumer culture was beginning to reassert itself after we had tried to kind of fend off capitalism in the 60s. And so I was looking for somewhere to go. But somewhere where I could, and I'm an anthropologist by profession, so somewhere I could be an anthropologist, but I could also be politically active. And Israel was a place, because I was Jewish, that I could be politically active. And there was another point to it. In the 60s, it was also, there was a stream of identity politics. Don't forget you had Alex Haley's book Roots, and so the African Americans really became the first ethnic group in the United States to validate where they came from. Rather than melting, because obviously after 400 years they weren't melting very well in the melting pot, rather than that, they began to reassert, and Roots was the expression of that African background. And then you began to have Cesar Chavez, what was called the Chicano community at that time, the Latinos. And then you had, you know, all the other ethnic groups began to say, yeah, you know, we also have our trees and our heritage that we don't want to lose. So in all of that, you know, I'm Jewish, not religious in any way. And I had no real Jewish background, but I wanted to kind of explore that identity.
Did you see Israel back then as this doughty little country that had been assaulted in its cradle by the Arab nations and was this wonderfully brave country and nation states surrounded by terrorists trying to kill Jews? And
No. By that time, the occupation had happened.
What year did you come to Israel?
Well, so I came in 73. As a graduate student, I did my PhD field work here. But you see, on the contrary, I came as a leftist. I didn't come as a Zionist. I came as a leftist because I wanted to be involved in the political struggle, but I didn't find the political struggle in the U.S. to be relevant to me. I just didn't feel any tie, you know, to the labor movement, or I certainly wouldn't be part of the movement for African-American rights. I'm not a woman. In fact, I organized with Father Grappi, who was a very famous figure in the 60s, a Catholic priest in Milwaukee, where I was in school, one of the big gatherings of the left in the United States. It was kind of the last gasp of the 60s. I was one of the organizers with him. And we organized this whole conference. People came from all over the United States from the left. And the whole program, you know, was based on, you know, labor issues, women's issues, racial issues. There was all kinds of class things because it was a very Marxist thing. And then there was liberation theology because it was at a church. And all the issues, capitalism. And, you know, and then the first day of the conference, I'm trying to say to myself, well, where do I fit into this? And I didn't really fit into all these American-defined issues. I was somehow outside of that. None of them really spoke. And it really... I really came to realize that I really don't have a future in the United States in any meaningful political sense. And I was, again, political in the 60s. I was in our blood, sort of. So I came to Israel as another front in the revolution, let's say. Here, I was very Asian. It was new. I mean, the Six-Day War had only happened 6 years before I came. 1967, I came in 73, and I came just in the Boer War. But the first thing I did when I got here was I joined the Israeli peace movement. So this isn't a story of somebody who came as a Zionist and saw Israel as this Paul Newman Exodus kind of society, and then gets disillusioned and finds his way to the left. I came as a leftist. I came knowing there's an occupation, knowing about the Palestinian issue and so on. So it was a mixture of kind of wanting to come to Israel, and not in any Jewish way, but, you know, what I liked about Israel was the national sense of it. You know, it was a, you know, like I told you earlier in our own conversations, I would define myself more as a cultural Zionist. In other words, I do think the Jewish people have a tie to this country, but there can't be an Israel in a political sense, because that's a form of settler colonialism. It's a form of oppression. You're displacing the Palestinian people. My idea is to, on the one hand, kind of reconnect with a place that's meaningful for Jews, with a Jewish population, but on the other hand, work very much for an end to... we didn't use those terms in those days, the colonial thing, but the end of the occupation, to a just peace with Palestinians. You know? So I sort of combined my own personal identity issues with my left beliefs, you know, working for social justice.
And back then, when you got here, maybe within 3 or 4 or 5 years, Did you slowly start to see Israel as a settler colonial state, maybe even as an apartheid state?
That's been only in the last 10, 15 years. That whole vocabulary of settler colonialism only really arises recently, in the last decade or so. No, on the contrary, I think it was more the idea that the occupation happened, but it was temporary, and our job was to end the occupation. It was certainly a two-state idea in those days. We didn't have much contact with Palestinians. I mean, they also, this is just at a time when the PLO is beginning to emerge gradually. The PLO had not yet adopted. That was way later in 1988 when they adopted the two-state solution. That was a disaster for them. So they were still in an anti-colonial mindset. That was their struggle, was anti-colonial. So they were trying to liberate Palestine from the Zionists.
And militant and armed struggle.
And armed struggle.
Quote-unquote terrorism, assaults on
airliners. Well, you had the airliners and all that. Yeah, armed struggle against it. But the idea was that there would still be an Israel somehow. I mean, I was an Israeli. So the idea was to end the occupation. Ending the occupation means, it wasn't clear what our agenda was, actually. We wanted to, because the whole thing was new, and we didn't, there weren't settlements yet. There are a couple little settlements beginning, but you didn't have Begin, you didn't have Sharon. I mean, the right way, this was still a labor, socialist country, kind of. And what happened in 48, the Nakba, we didn't use the word Nakba, that wasn't a term yet. So what happened in 48 was already kind of in the background. It wasn't part of the political discussion. And don't forget that, the Palestinians really, I think after the Great Revolt of 1936 to 1939, when they rose up in revolt against the British and the Zionists, and were put down in a brutal way. So they were so exhausted, and in a way, their infrastructure was so destroyed, and their economy, that they weren't able to resist effectively in 1948 being put down. Their repression was so severe in the 30s that they hadn't recovered by 1948. So 1948, the knock happens, and the Palestinians are just knocked out. Half the Palestinians are now refugees. 85% of the Palestinians became Israel were driven out as refugees. Their villages and towns were destroyed. Their lands were taken. I mean, they were really reeling. They were against the ropes. So by the early 1970s, they were just beginning with the PLO. And don't forget, the PLO only came under Palestinian directive rather than Egyptian sponsorship only after the 67 war. So in 1973, the PLO was just in the stages of kind of organizing itself and the struggle and articulating this, and Palestinians coming in, so that everything that happened before in 48, the Nakba, wasn't a part of the conversation. So in other words, we were in a, we had an occupation. We wanted to make peace with Palestinians, but it wasn't clear. Certainly we didn't adopt as Israelis the idea of liberating Palestine and getting rid of Israel and becomes a Palestine. That we didn't buy into. We thought of an Israel that would somehow make peace with. What that meant was very vague.
Try to fast forward, because we could talk for hours about all this history.
That's 50 years ago.
And that was 50 years ago. How did ICAT come about? When did you form the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions? And let's move through this kind of relatively quickly.
Well, I was very involved in the peace movement then for many years. And in 1996, during the Oslo process, Netanyahu was elected for the first time. And Netanyahu was elected on an explicitly anti-Oslo peace process program. When he was elected, the occupation was reasserting itself in a very brutal way. So in 1997, a number of Israeli peace groups came together, and I was part of that. And we decided we have to re-engage in fighting the occupation. We had, as a peace movement, we had given Oslo a chance. So from 93, the end of 93, when Oslo begins, to the election of Netanyahu in 96, middle of 96, we had kind of stopped our activities. There wasn't protests. There was, you know, we were giving the negotiations a chance, even if we were doubtful about them. But it was clear by 96, 96, engage. Now we re-engage. Well, we went out and talked to some Palestinian partners that we had, and they're the ones who suggested to us that we focus on house demolitions. It was one of the most painful parts of the occupation. We didn't know anything about it, and we hadn't really worked with Palestinians in a systematic way. So we set up ICAD, which was the Israeli Committee. Why committee? Because it was an aggregate of all these different peace organizations that came together against house demolitions. And the idea is we would focus on that, but we wouldn't start a new group because the other groups still existed. So one group would focus on settlements. One group would focus on the remnants of the occupation. Another group, you know, in other words, is sort of division. We focused on house demolitions. And so we began in 1997, the group at that time, of that particular group. But in fact, what happened was that we were very effective, if I can say so. We managed, we got funding from the EU and from the UN and from churches and from all kinds of places. We had an office, we had a staff. And so we became one of the leading organizations. We were more than just an activist group. In other words, we really got to know the lay of the land. Before us, we pioneered working with Palestinians. Before our activities, Israeli peace groups would have a demonstration on their own. They would initiate it, and they might go to the West Bank, and they might have a demonstration against a settlement, but they initiated it. It was Israeli speakers, and it had nothing to do with Palestinians. But you couldn't work on the house demolition issue without being in touch with families, finding out what's happening, working with local communities, working with Palestinian partners. So, and even you know, the demolition in Annatha. We didn't even know where Annatha was. Annatha is a Palestinian town, kind of. Half of it's in Jerusalem. We didn't know anything about the lay of the land. I have to say, for all these years, the Israeli peace movement really didn't know much about Palestine or Palestinians, or, for example, who's issuing demolition orders. We didn't really know that much about the civil administration, the whole mechanism of it, what the intent was, who's getting demolished. We didn't know. I mean, I have to say, it's embarrassing. But after all these years, we had stayed at the level of being against occupation, but we never got, you know, really involved. What we discovered was two things, just really. First of all, that house demolitions is the essence of the colonization. We discovered as we backed into it that it really is the essence of the so-called conflict because it has to do with displacement, and house demolitions is that.
And dispossession.
But at the same time, we had to deliver. In other words, you know, you can't make a contact with a family whose home has been demolished and come and say, well, we're in solidarity with you, we're really sorry, you know, and do hold up a sign and then go home. Families say, hey, wait a minute, what are you going to rebuild for us? Support us financially? Are you going to bring forward politically? And that forced us really to get serious about our political work in a way. It hadn't been that serious before. It had been more of a protest movement.
How many homes have been demolished over the course of 56 years of Israel's occupation?
In the Nakba, you know, in 48, 750,000 Palestinians were thrown out of the country, were displaced. But their villages and towns and urban areas were intact. They weren't destroyed during the war. Israel took all their lands and gave them to the kibbutzim and the moshavim. And then from 48 on into the 60s, it systematically demolished more than 500 entire Palestinian villages and towns and urban areas inside Israel. So that destruction to prevent the refugees from coming back didn't happen in the heat of battle. So that destruction was something like, we've counted, something like 52,000 Palestinian homes were destroyed in the Nakba and in the wake of the Nakba. Okay? 52,000. Fast forward to 1967. From 1967 until today, we leave Gaza, this last operation in Gaza since October out for a minute. From 1970 until today, another 60,000 homes have been demolished in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza, but also inside Israel. What's important, the Nakba never ended. And Israel is continuing to settle inside Israel, to confiscate Palestinian land inside Israel, and to demolish. There are some years in which there's more demolition inside Israel of Israeli citizens who are Palestinians than there are in the occupied territory. So 52,000 in the Nakba, 60,000 in the occupied territories since 67, and now in the last 6 months, since October 2023, you know, the Hamas attack, another 300,000 homes have been demolished in Gaza in just in the last 6 months, 70% of the housing. So you can see from all of that, not only the tremendous and tragic impact this has, I mean, you can't imagine the depth of the trauma, losing your home, people getting, it's a very violent process. So people get killed in the process, and it's traumatizing. I mean, this, it's not like a demolition happens, it's too bad, and you get on with your life the next day. Your kids are traumatized, it stays with you forever. And there are many families in which their home, we've had one family work with six times their home has been demolished. In Gaza, let's not forget, 80% of the people in Gaza are refugees themselves. So they've been demolished and driven out in the Nakba and driven into Gaza. And now, and this isn't the first time their homes have been demolished. There's been tremendous attacks, you know, over the last 20 years of Israel and Gaza. So in other words, I'm just saying that the scale and the violence, but this almost obsession of Israel with demolishing Palestinian homes has to do with ethnic cleansing and with the basic fact of settler colonialism, which is Israel trying to replace Palestine, to transform an Arab country into a Jewish country, and to replace the indigenous Palestinian population with a Jewish one.
Is what's going on
and you can't
Gaza,
do that without house demolitions.
Is what's going on in Gaza right now genocidal? Is Israel committing genocide in Gaza?
No, it's for sure it's committing genocide, which means the destruction of a whole or a part of a people. It's clear, you know, there's been 40,000 children killed, you know, in the last 6 months. And it's not only physical killing, you know, genocide has to do with making it impossible for the culture to function, to culture itself, and making it impossible for the people to reproduce themselves in the next generation. They become refugees and they simply lose their entire collective existence. That's a part of genocide. But what's important, and we put out a statement, ICAD, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, just a few weeks after it started, saying not only is this genocide in Gaza, but it's just the latest flare-up of genocide. Genocide is built into settler colonialism. Like I said, you can't displace a people, take their land, and replace them with your own people as settlers, and then completely redo the country without destroying it. And violently throwing out those people and killing them because they have to resist. They can't not resist, and so they get killed in the resistance. So the genocide is built into the settler colonial project. So basically what we're saying is genocide began in 1948, 47 even. It didn't on October 7th in Gaza. And so even if you have doubts, you know, the court has said it hasn't ruled yet. The ICJ has ruled this is plausible genocide. Even if you can say, well, Gaza itself now doesn't rise to the level of genocide, if you put it within the context of the last 56, 57 years of systematic genocidal settler colonialism against Palestinians, you know, in that broader context, is definitely genocide and ongoing genocide.
And yet, U.S. Defense Minister Austin and National Security Advisor Kirby, what's his first name, John Kirby?
Yeah, I think so.
They say, no, absolutely not. There's no evidence. We've got no evidence that Israel is committing genocide. Of course, if they said, yeah, we think it's pretty plausible, they'd be complicit.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they could. We'd barely imagine them acknowledging the plausibility of this. They say, no, there's It's not happening.
Yeah, I mean, that's not just genocide, apartheid. You know, when all these human rights organizations, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem, which is the main Israeli human rights organization, plus the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Territories, all came out saying this is what Israel has built here is apartheid. We already have an apartheid regime in Palestine. 2 minutes after the Amnesty report was released, an American ambassador here said, that's not the language we use. We don't use language or genocide, you know, certainly. In other words, it's not in their vocabulary.
They don't use the language of international law.
They don't use the language of international law. This whole idea of a rule of national order is ridiculous. It plays no role whatsoever in their considerations. And so for them, you know, it has to do with interests. It's all transactional. And Israel, you know, has much more to deliver to the United States than the Palestinians could ever deliver. And so we support them, and we can't use those kinds of terms.
So today is the 19th of April, and we've just watched Antony Blinken on television commenting on, you know, Israel's response to supposedly limited response to Iran's response to Israel's bombing of their consular offices in Damascus. And Blinken is saying
the only thing
that's coming between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas.
Hamas
is entirely to blame.
That's right. So that's, you know, I mean, that's...
And you were commenting.
You know, I commented, first of all, it's sad, it's depressing, it's revealing. If that is genuinely the analysis of the United States from Blinken and all these, but they have an entire State Department, they have departments of analysis and research, and they have intelligence services, and they have think tanks. I mean, there's 100 think tanks that feed into American policy, and the universities that feed in. If that's their analysis, that Hamas is the only barrier to a ceasefire, it shows you how poor the world is run in terms of understanding what's going on. I mean it's childish. My grocer would say that.
They have all the intelligence. They know
the intelligence. But they also have the academic analysis. They have the federal. You've got people who spend their career lives researching the Middle East experts, Palestine experts, Israeli. And that's what you come up with? I mean, a child would know that's not the case. But again, it gets back to this deeper issue, and that is that it is cynical. The words don't mean anything. Really, you know, what the United States wants to do is to preserve its and the G7's hegemony in the Middle East. And it's challenged by China and challenged by Russia with the Belt and Road system and, you know, Saudi Arabia has just been brought into the BRICS alliance of the global south. You know, and there's anger over what Israel's doing. So a lot of countries are beginning to get critical of Israel, and it's making it hard for the Arab countries in the Gulf, you know, to normalize with Israel. But normalization is the name of the game, because unless the United States can marginalize and quietize this pesky Palestine, doesn't want to deal with the Palestinian issue per se, because it would cost too much political capital. It's a lose-lose. If you really forced Israel into a two-state solution and removed 750,000 settlers,